ANZ Voices welcomes you to the Business of Bloodstock podcast with Tim Rowe and Charmaine Bukovec.
On this episode of the Business of Bloodstock, we are joined by a very special guest in David Chester. David has been in the industry for a very long time, and our podcast this week is going to be split into two episodes to give David the time and dedication his stories needed.
That's right, Charmaine. Normally we have Share and Success, proudly sponsored by Jimmy Unweller and Avesta Bloodstock. But given David's got so many tales and stories and things to tell, we thought wouldn't do it justice if we had to cut him off too soon. So we had an absolute ball recording this episode of the Business of Bloodstock podcast, and hope you enjoy it as well. Well, for our sixth episode of the Business of Bloodstock podcast, I'm delighted to have David Chester, a doyen of the bloodstock industry in Australia and around Asia and the world, I'd say, David. So I'm glad you've joined Charmaine and I for just a casual chat about you and Magic Millions, and we'll see where this leads us. I'm sure you've got a story or two for us.
Good morning, Charmaine. Good morning, Tim. Yeah, I've got a story. When you say I'm a doyen around Australia and Asia and the world, I've never been to America. All Jerry does with me is send me up to Asia. I don't go to all those famous places at Kentucky and Newmarket and wherever. So I'm just the guy that looks after the local and Asian market, which I love, I've got to say.
I'm sure there's still time. You could chaperone Barry over to Keeneland there in November.
I think at 77 years old, they might let me into Keeneland.
I'm sure you'd be fine. Where do we head from here, Charmaine? David, can you take us back sort of to the start? You've been involved in the industry more than 50 years, it might be nearly 54 years this year.
Yeah, I started in 1966. My first yearling sale, March Queensland yearling sale, was in 1966 at the Brisbane Exhibition Ground. And actually, I applied for jobs. I was very keen on pigs in those days as a young guy, and I tried to get into Fitzsimmons, which is a pig company in Brisbane, to sell pigs, and they didn't have a vacancy. So then I went to Dalgetty's, and they said, we'll let you know in a week. And then I went to a company called the Australian Estates Company, which is an old English-owned company. Actually, a Lord Mayor of London was the chairman, and we were a wool broking company, and sheep and cattle and horses and goats, and they said, can you play cricket? And I was captain of cricket at Toowoomba Grammar School, my old school. I said, yeah, I play a bit of cricket. They said, well, you can if you can start work on Monday if you play cricket with us on Sunday. So I made 50 runs. So I was a hero before I started. But I started, Tim and Charmaine, I started in the dispatch department, which is posting letters. So, you know, I learned a lot about, you know, how to address letters and how to put stamps on and run errands down to the wool store and all that sort of thing. And I was doing that for about, I don't know, 3 or 4 months. And in that time, the Vietnam War was on, and I had to register, put my name in the hat for the Vietnam War. And there was about 12 of us. They called us cadets. We were cadets at Australian States. About 12 of us started. Six of us got called up, and I missed out. And that was one of the luckiest things in my life, because if I'd got called up to go to Vietnam, when I came back to Australian States, they probably would have sent me out to a branch at Roma or Cunnamulla or Chinchilla, and I wouldn't have gotten into this industry. But so I missed out on that. And then there was an old guy that was the did all the pedigrees in the stud stock department, and he got really sick and retired. And they asked me, would I like to take over the job of doing the pedigrees for the dairy cows, the beef cattle, and the thoroughbred horses? And I said, yeah, I'd love to have a go. Because when I was at boarding school, instead of doing my homework, I used to look at the old stallions' passing glance and smoky eyes and all those old stallions that no one listening will remember. But so I was a bit keen on that. So that's how I got my first taste of the industry.
What a sliding door moment, David. That's incredible. I didn't know that you were almost conscripted. So I think that's a very lucky thing for the entire industry that that turn of fate occurred. So you started obviously 1966, and the first Magic Million sale was in 1986. Is that right?
Yes, but Charmaine, going back a little bit before then, we sold at the Brisbane Exhibition Ground, and then in 1978 or 79, Carl Waugh, Merrill Kruger, who's Lyndhurst Stud, the late Gordon McNichol, who was Gainsborough Lodge Stud, and a couple of other breeders, they bought some land at the Gold Coast or talked about moving down to the Gold Coast instead of having the sale at Brisbane Exhibition Ground, which was a pretty ordinary place because it's where they sold the bulls. That's where we had the bull sales. And they bought the land then off the Gold Coast Turf Club. They bought, I think, 10 blocks. But there was the whole industry in Queensland was very much against moving to the Gold Coast because they said, oh, you can't have a sale down there because it's a holiday destination. It's not the capital city. All the sales in the world virtually are in capital cities. You can't do that. And actually, as I told you, the company I worked for, Australia and the States, had a big wool client. So one of their biggest wool clients took his wool clip away from our company because Australia and the States shouldn't be going to a den of iniquity like the Gold Coast to have a horse sale. How do you like that?
Didn't know that either. That's a very interesting, I think that a bit of foresight has worked really well for Magic Millions because it is very much a destination sale. And I think it's a great spot on the Gold Coast there. It's a bit of a holiday and a business affair. But how did the January date come about?
Well, yeah, anyway, let me finish. So in 1980, we had the Golden Nugget sale. So, and then they were going okay, and we got a few southern horses up. But in those days, none of the Tommy Smiths or the Bart Cummings, they wouldn't come to Queensland to buy our horses. So, so old Carl, Carl Waugh, I shouldn't call him old Carl, Carl Waugh rang me from his property at Dalby, and he said, you call me Chester, and I called him Mr. Waugh. He said, Chester, what do you think of this? If we have a sale of 200 horses, 200 yearlings, and have $1 million race the next year, how do you think that'd go? And I said, yes, Mr. Waugh, that's a really good idea. And I thought, what's coming next? But he said, to pay for it, he said, the entry fee's got to be $10,000. Now, $10,000 back in 1985, because the first sale was 1986, that was a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And I was the only one, you know, in the bloodstock department. I used to do the pedigrees and everything. I was the one that had to go out and canvass for yearlings to try to get 200 yearlings to make up the numbers in the first sale. And it's quite interesting because I was just looking at the old catalogue yesterday, but you had John Massara, who was Middlebrook Park Stud in those days. He was a good supporter. Woodland Stud, which is now Dali, of course, they were one of their biggest vendors. Norman Von Nieder, the champion golfer. Iris Moore, the wife of George Moore, she had a horse in. We had Mr. Holmes of Court from Western Australia, Johnny Muir, who still sells with us, and a lot of the Queensland studs, of course. But I tell the story that I went on to a lot of farms and they were all listening, very polite, and had a cup of tea. And then when I said the entry fee was $10,000, they said, get out of here, put the dogs on me. They were horrified. But even Jerry Harvey, who's, you know, not that generous, he put three yearlings in the sale. I think one was by Gypsy Kingdom, another one by Best Western, two of his stallions. So that's how it started. And it was quite interesting because Carl said we had to have 200 yearlings. We had to actually sell 200 yearlings to pay for it. So he said, we better have 20 reserves because, you know, at the sales you get the withdrawals. So I remember now we had the catalogue of 200 plus another 20. And the people, 201, which was Basil Nolan, Raheem Studd, still with us, they were ringing me up and saying, oh, has there been a withdrawal yet? There's been a withdrawal yet? We want to get our horse in. So that's how keen they were, the ones that decided to go that way.
Tim?
Yeah, and from there, the first race, well, Magic Millions Day, and it's a huge extravaganza now, and week-long event. And, of course, we've had Barry on this podcast previously discussing what's ahead with night racing and so forth. But how important was it that, you know, the first race day worked, and, of course, Snippets won the first one?
Yeah, well, that's another good story, because the establishment were very much against this closed race idea. It never had been done in the world before. No one had come up, and of course now, you know, it's copied all over the world, this race race sale concept, and this was the very first one. So we were told by the powers that be, by the establishment, that the race would never be accepted, the prize money would never be accepted on the sires list, and all this sort of thing. And there was a lot of antagonism against it. But as it turned out, and I think we should erect a monument for Snippets, because as you say, Tim, in the first sale we had Snippets, we had Mother Duck, we had Prince Anton, we had, I think, four or five runners that year got into the Golden Slipper. But let me tell you a story about Snippets. This is a good one, because I spoke to Richard Foster yesterday, who was one of the vendors in the first sale, and he said, yeah, David, he said, I was. But he said, you know, I could tell you a story about Snippets, because where we have the parade ring adjacent to our office, there were two round yards there. And the float driver brought Snippets up from Melbourne, put the horse in a round yard, put Snippets in a round yard, no feed, no water. And Richard and a friend of his, they rescued the horse, got him out, they put him in a box and gave him a feed and a drink. And then Carl Waugh came and said, well, where's this horse from? It looks bloody terrible. What are we going to do? Anyway, that's where Sally Rogers, who ended up training him, that's where she came into it, because they sent Snippets to Sally Rogers because she was a bit of an equestrian and said, please clean this horse up. Have him looking sort of presentable. Anyway, that's Snippets, and he went on and was a Group 1 winner at a champion side. But, you know, if we didn't have those good horses in that very first sale and race, I think Magic Millions probably wouldn't have proceeded as well as it did, because everyone said, how can you get out of 200 yearlings, how can you get, you know, any decent horses? And we were very, very lucky that we got those horses.
I just want to move back, David. Why the, you know, and it's pivotal now, but the January date, it's a packed schedule as it is, selling schedule as we know now, with sales here, there and everywhere in New Zealand. Why basically early January, you know, kids are still on school holidays. Why that date?
Very good question, Tim. Very good question. I'll tell you why. Because when I went down to Canberra for the first sale at yearlings, I had to go to New Haven Park, and I met J.W. Kelly, which John Kelly's grandfather, you know, Richard's father. And J.W. Kelly was, I think, president of the New South Wales Breeders in those days. And he said to me, he said, David, he said, look, we don't mind the concept, but Carl was going to have the sale in March. He said, if you have the sale before Trentham, which was the sale in New Zealand, before Trentham in New Zealand, we will support you, because he said there's too much money every year spent at the New Zealand sales, and we've been asking Inglis if they'd put on a sale before New Zealand, and they wouldn't. So that's the reason that the sale went to January. And, you know, thanks to old Mr. Kelly, that I think it's really worked, because it's holiday time, people come here, and as Charmaine said before, people just love coming to the Gold Coast. And I've always said, you know, we sell good horses, but one of the big reasons people come here is that they love the Gold Coast and it's a relaxing time of the year.
Speaking of Inglis, David, there is a rumour, I've been told, that you almost crossed across to the Arch Rival at one stage. Tell us about that story.
Oh, Charmaine, no, don't ask me. I sort of...
You would look good in blue.
Yeah, well, it's a good story. when Reg Inglis resigned or retired or whatever happened, Inglis had a people out on the lookout for someone to take Reg's place. So what do you call them? The headhunting people to interview for the job. So I had a call from this lady, and she said, "Oh, David, we know you're managing director at the Gold Coast, but we've been watching you, and we'd like you to apply for the managing director role at Inglis's." And I said, "Oh, that's very nice for you to ask me." I sort of didn't know what to say. I was a bit shocked, and I said, "Look, I'm very happy here at Magic Millions, but thank you very much for asking. I'm going to stay here." Anyway, I hung up and I thought, shit, did I say the right bloody thing? Then I rang a good mate of mine, Neville Stewart, and I said, "Neville, I said, they just rang me up for this Inglis job." And he said, well, what did you say to him?" I said, "Oh, no, I'm not interested." He said, "You're a fool. You should have asked them how much they're going to pay." I said, "Yeah, I should have." And anyway, then about half an hour later, I got a call from Jerry Harvey. He put one of his girls, Ian Singo, put one of his girls up in the office to ring me as a bit of a joke. So I don't think they were testing. I think they just did it as a joke.
You could have got more money out of Jerry.
Because another story is Jerry bought Magic Millions in 1997, last century. And I was in at the sale at Inglis's in Sydney under the big fig tree, beautiful old tree. And I was there, and Jerry said, "How's Magic Millions going, David?" I said, "Oh, it's going well, Jerry, but they're trying to sell it." He said, "It's a good company, isn't it?" And I said, "Yeah, Jerry, it's a good, you sell the horses there." He said, "Yeah, I might be interested in buying. How much do they want?" And I think it was about $6.5 million or something. And he said, "Who do I ring?" And so I said, "I'll let you know." Anyway, I rang Max Warner, who was the chairman of Magic Millions in those days. And he rang him up, and Jerry bought the company, as you know. But I should have said, "I'll handle it, Jerry," because I don't know, they had some U-Butte agency trying to sell it. And I bloody well sold it and got nothing, but I'm still working here, so I'm very grateful. But just an ongoing story about that: when Jerry bought it, they said, "You want to do due diligence. You know, when you pay $6 or $7 million for something, you always do your due diligence and see what the place is like and everything." Joe, "No, I don't know the place. I don't have to do due diligence." It probably was going to cost him some money to do it, so he didn't do it. And then I reckon about a year later or 2 years later, I had to ring Jerry and say, "Oh, the Gold Coast Turf Club are putting the rent up on the car park," because, you know, we use the Gold Coast Turf Club car park for our sales. And he said, "I thought we owned the car park." I said, "No, Jerry, we don't." So that's another nice little story.
So did Singo buy into Magic Millions at the same time as Jerry, or had?
Oh, gee, that's another good story. Because Jerry bought it himself, and then he said, and this Jerry told me himself, he said, "Oh, I don't want the whole thing myself." He said, "Singo's a good mate of mine. I'll ring Singo up and see if he wants to take a bit." And I can't swear, but I won't tell you exactly what he told Jerry, but Singo had just had his dispersal sale. He sold all his mares, and because he reckons they all died at Broomby, because that Jerry was at Broomby in those days. They all used to die, and he had no luck there, so he got rid of everything. And he said, "Jerry, I've just sold everything." He said, "F off. I'm not interested." Then 20 minutes later, he rings Jerry up and said, "Yeah, it's not a good idea." He said, "I might make some money with Magic Millions. Better to be able to sell other people's horses than trying to sell my own." So that's how he came into it. And then, of course, Rob Ferguson came in, because Rob was a banker. And so they came in at Jerry. They had a quarter each, and Jerry had the rest. So that's and then, you know, years later, when I got into trouble and they sacked me as managing director, everything, Singo sold his shares. And he's always said to me after, he said, "The silliest thing I've ever done in my life," because he said, "I love Magic Millions. The silliest thing I ever did in my life was would sell my shares. And I'm very sorry, John, you did.
Jerry might sell back some for a premium, I'm sure.
I don't think so. Now Katie's involved. When Singo and Rob were involved, Katie wasn't all that keen, but now she's got right in behind it, and she started the women's and racing and the big events we have. So it's gone from a very little sale of 200 horses now to, you know, a big carnival.
On Jerry and Singo, for that matter, they're two big personalities, of course, they're wealthy, even, you know, Katie as well. What are they like? We see, you know, particularly Jerry at the sales, and he wanders around like, you know, everyone else, and he's as passionate as ever about the horses, it seems. He's at, you know, I saw him in Adelaide just recently, the Adelaide sale, and he's obviously invested in Perth and Tassie. Just must love it.
Yeah, well, Jerry's a real people's person, you know, and I remember Queensland Events rang me, this is years and years ago, I mean, 25 years ago, there was going to be a big pro-am golf day. And they said, oh, Jerry plays a bit of golf, which he's not bad at his age. I can still beat him, though. They said, would you ask Jerry, would he like to play with Greg Norman in this pro-am? And Jerry rang me back and said, David, I'd rather play with you than with Greg Norman. So that's the sort of person Jerry is. He's a real people's person. But I'll tell you what, the board meetings in those days with Jerry and Singo, I mean, there wasn't much business done because my predecessor, really good bloke, Don Hancock, and yeah, you can thank him for ringside dining. Yeah, Don was the first guy to start, you know, the ringside dining, which now it's copied everywhere. And also the inward buyer scheme where we bring buyers in from all over, and Don Hancock sent me to South Africa the three times, you know, to and that's when South Africa was spending a fair bit of money here. So Don did a lot, but Don used to produce these board papers. They'd be, you know, 2 inches thick, and Don was a very, very, you know, focused guy. So bring the board papers, and then be going through it, and Singo would say, oh, what about, you know, what are the bad debts or something? And Don said, they're on page 50. He said, I don't read board papers. After all the work Don had done, none of them, except Rob Ferguson would have read them, but none of the others would have read it. But it was all about, the board meetings were all about their private lives, having a go at one another. It wasn't much about business in those days. But I'll tell you a good story about Singo. Because early in the piece, he bought a filly here called Belle de Jour, who, you know, won the Golden Slipper.
Of course, famously.
Famously, yeah, Mr. Start and everything. But Anyway, he bought her here, and, you know, after the sale, they've all got to be scoped. So they took Belle de Jour, and she was a bit of a fiery little girl, and they took her to the scoping barn, and she went ballistic in the scoping barn, played up, kicked, and she took all this skin off her. She was a real mess. Anyway, they must have rung Singo, so Singo rings me, and he said, this is an effing disgrace. I'm going to sue Magic Guineas, who's the part owner. I'm not going to pay for the filly. I'm going to sue Magic Guineas. Anyway, I'm not going to pay for it. And so we sort of got her out of the scoping barn and sent her to Howard Wilson, who was owned where Hoss Heinrich is now, and Howard nursed her back to shape. And, you know, she was as good as gold. She just lost a bit of skin, that's all. She was a bit of a mess. So anyway, that he wasn't going to pay for it, and that turned out to win the Golden Slipper. And another story with Belle de Jour is that Singer was invited to Bob Hawke's 70th birthday, 70th birthday, and he said, what can I give Bob Hawke for his birthday, 70th birthday? I bought that filly at the sale. She's got a bit of bruises and bumps on her. I'll give him a share in that. So he gave Bob Hawke a share in Belle de Jour. So she won the Golden Slipper. So, in this industry, mate, a lot of funny things happen.
And that was, of course, that slipper, of course, you missed the start. That was the year that Singo shouted the public bar, wasn't it, after she won?
Yeah, but he also won, but he won a race at the Gold Coast on Magic Winning Day or something. I can't remember what it was. He said, if it wins, it was in the paper, if it wins, I'm going to shout the bar. So anyway, it won, he shouted the bar, and then the bill came in to me. It was 50,000 or 40,000. I can't remember what it was, 30 years ago. And I rang up Jerry and I said, Jerry, we've got this bill from the guy. He said, just pay it. But seeing how big Nobe himself got all the credit and we paid for it. Well, I'm not sure what happened after the golden slipper. Sorry, John.
Some great stories coming out today, David. They are
absolutely... I hope I don't go to jail.
We haven't needed much editing yet. We'll be fine, David.
We haven't. We haven't sent anyone to jail just yet, David. So let's not start that now. You're known as the King of Asia. Tell us about how you developed those relationships.
Well, I can put it down to Don Hancock, my predecessor, because I hadn't even thought about Asia before Don. But my first trip overseas was to Malaysia, and because Don knew a steward at Perak Turf Club, which is Ipoh in Malaysia, and Don said, "Oh, we'll go over there and meet him and see if we can drum up a bit of business in Malaysia." And we went over there, and all I can remember, and this is why I'm not a tourist. When I go to overseas countries now in Asia, I go to the racetrack, I go to the hotel, and I go to the stables or farms, but I don't go as a tourist, because this guy, this steward, lovely old fellow, I can't remember his name, he took us to every frigging temple in Ipoh, Malaysia, and I had enough. I don't want to see any more temples or go sightseeing. So, but that's how it started. And Don sent me to South Africa, which is not Asia, but I went there three times, and that's where I met David Payne and Tony Millard in Hong Kong, and you know the good trainers are all young guys over there. This would have been 30 years ago I went there, and my first trip to China was in 2002, I think, and I went up there with a delegation, a government-led delegation, led by the late Tom Burns, who was Deputy Premier of Queensland. You're too young to remember, but he went up to China with Gough Whitlam, the first Australian politician that visited China, and he got the red star or the gold star or something, Tom Burns. So he knew everyone in China, and he'd retired from politics, but he was Queensland Trade Commissioner for China in those days. So that was when Domeland, Mr. Y.P. Chang, had started the Beijing Jockey Club. It built the first, well, not the first, but a big racetrack outside Beijing. And he imported trainers from France, from England, Australia, New Zealand, from everywhere. And he paid them all, paid all the jockeys. I mean, guys like Lee McKenzie are up there. A lot of guys that have gone on very well were up there. And I said to Tom Burns, look, in the itinerary, Tom, we've got to present, because we said we'd sponsor a race. And I said to Tom, please, half a day we've got to spend at Beijing Jockey Club to present the trophy for the race we're sponsoring. And he said, David, there's no racing in China. I said, Tom, there is. Oh, no, there's not. I said, there is. We've got to go there. So anyway, they put it in the program. So we got there. Tom couldn't believe it. And they even had sort of betting at the club. It was the profits were going to the Red Cross, so it was called the Red Cross Magic Million Cup, and we sponsored it for $10,000 Australian, and I got Tom Burns to present the trophy. So that was China, but we were the pioneers of talking about Asia. We were the pioneers of races in Singapore. We took tried horse to Singapore in 1994, 1995, 1996. I was the first auctioneer registered in Singapore. We had three sales in Macau, tried horses. We had one sale in Philippines, the tried horses. I remember Trevor Lobb went up there when Trevor was the boss of Woodlands. So that was the story with Asia. And then we were the first company to sell horses to China, a guy called Red Ning Ning, who's still going. I still have chats with him on WeChat. He bought the first horses, Australian horses, to go to China back last century.
On where is the... We've had Mike Kneebone on this podcast previously and talking about Singapore. is where is there a growth area in Asia, do you think, for the Australian and New Zealand market, for that matter? You know, is it still China? Obviously, we've got Yulong and Mr. Zhang investing enormous amounts. Is that where it is, or is it sort of peaked, do you think?
Well, getting back to Jerry, I remember Jerry said to me, he said, you know, in the back of my mind when I bought Magic Millions way back in 1997, at the back of my mind, he said, I thought one day China would come on stream as a big racing country and there wouldn't be enough horses in Australia to supply the China market. Now, China, you know, we haven't been able to get horses into China for the last 3 years. Now, they've lifted the import restrictions. Now, from, I think, the end of this year on, Australian horses will again be accepted into China. So China's a huge market, but until they start gambling or betting on racing, I don't think it's going to be as big ever as, say, Hong Kong is or Singapore could be. I mean, there's a new guy in Singapore, an Australian guy called Dale Brown, who's taken over as the racing manager. And Dale is a very, very good operator, and he is the big hope of Singapore coming back to where it was. Because when I first saw, or 30 years ago, Singapore was not that far behind Hong Kong. You know, that there were, their prize money wasn't that far apart. But Hong Kong's gone ahead in leaps and bounds, and Singapore's gone stagnant or gone backwards. But I'd say in the last 6 months or so, there's probably 100 horses being sold out of Australia to Singapore. So there is hope for Singapore. And if anyone asks me, where's the best place for an expatriate to race a horse in Asia, you'd have to say Singapore, because Hong Kong you can't get into because you've got to be a member of the Hong Kong Jockey Club, you've got to be a Hong Kong resident. Japan, you've got to be a multi-millionaire. There's a few Australian owners that are JRA members, but very difficult. Malaysia racing's prize money is so bad. The best place is Singapore. And I think my opinion is that Singapore over the next 5 or 10 years is going to really going to go ahead in leaps and bounds.
Yeah, sorry, Charmaine. David, you've told us many amusing stories so far, but I believe at one Magic Millions sale there was a wedding on mid-sale.
Jeez, how did you find all this out, Tim?
Again,
John said, thanks, John. John Singleton. Came up at a board meeting. I said, there's a mate of mine. I can't remember who. I think it was a boxer or something. He said he's got no friends and he's getting married. And he's got nowhere to get married and no friends. So I told him he can get married at the national sale. The national was the broodmare sale, I think. So it was all organised that after lot 251 that would stop the sale and the marriage celebrant would come in and they were on the stage, the groom and the bride, and the marriage celebrant went on for about 15 minutes, the wedding. Everyone's bored as hell, just sitting there watching the bloody wedding. And then the wedding finished and the next horse in, 252, was owned by Brian Maheen. And Brian was a bloody good bloke. But it didn't sell. It was passed in. Oh, and he went right off his tree. He was going to sue us for stopping the sale, having a wedding and not being able to sell his horse. But luckily we sold it later, so... it was all forgiven.
I wonder if, first off, that might have been a red flag for the bride later on that the groom had no friends. But I wonder if that marriage actually lasted or if it parted ways.
I have got no idea. I really don't care.
We might see. That's a very interesting thing.
There's an idea for you, Charmaine. It just comes in handy for a wedding venue.
It just causes a lot of grief, that's all.
Thanks, Tim, for landing me in that one. Now, you have been on amazing trips around the world with Magic Millions, David, but...
No, we keep saying around the world.
Well, I'm trying to, you know, talk it up a bit, but rumour has it, when was the last time you took a holiday?
Oh, I don't believe in holidays. My life is one long holiday. I love what I'm doing. And I tell you what, I shouldn't tell you this story, but I will. But when I was working in Australia and the States, the guy, he's no longer with us, but the guy I was working for, he didn't like me particularly much. He was trying to get rid of me. And I took my wife and myself, before we had kids, we went on a trip to Europe. And I went to Goss. It's the only time I've been over there. I paid for it myself. But I was about 26 or 27 or 28. Anyway, the time I was away, I was always worried that, you know, they'd put someone else in my job. And I used to ring the office every week, and I just had this worry, and it was true, because when I came back, this other guy was sitting in my desk, but he got kicked out very quickly. So that's sort of always in the back of my mind, even though I'm 77 and I'm still here and I've been in the company all my life, it put me off holidays. And I've had one holiday. We went on a houseboat in on the Broadwater here with my wife and two kids. Emma wasn't born then, so that was my last one. She's about 34, I think. So when Vin Cox was here, he'd come in, David, you've got to take some holidays. So, and he said, there's pressure on me from Jerry or Katie or something that you've got to take holidays. So I said, okay. So I took 3 weeks and I came into work every day those 3 weeks.
So is that why you keep Nick Long so close, just in case he's going to knife you, take the job?
No. But you know, I get bored on Sunday afternoon at the weekend. So, I love Saturdays because I can watch the races and I play a game of golf with my wife on Sunday morning, and then Sunday afternoon I'm bored. I can't wait to get back to work on Monday morning. You've got to admit, Charmaine, it's a very interesting job, isn't it?
Oh, look, I think, you know, if you love what you do, you never work a day in your life, right? So, you know, we're so blessed to be in an industry where it is very much you're loving what you do, and you can combine, you know, friends and family with work and everything else. So I think we're very lucky. But the R word doesn't exist in your vocabulary then, does it?
No. It's a wonderful industry. You meet some great people, you know, you really do. I was just reading through the rich list. I see Jerry's number 43 or something in the rich list that came out yesterday. But there's quite a few of our you know, people. And Gina Reinhardt is number one. She was at our sale 2 years ago, sitting with Katie on the table watching the sale. And hopefully one day she might get into some racehorses. But it's you meet some great people, and not so much the rich people, but the little battlers. And as an auctioneer, I always enjoyed selling for those little battlers and trying to get them a little bit more money. I'd much prefer to sell a horse for a battler that wanted $10,000 for it, that makes $15,000, than a horse that makes $500,000. The owner wanted $500,000. I get a lot of enjoyment out of trying to help the little people in the industry.
Behind the rostrum there, David, you've done it for a long time. Is there any sort of stories that come to mind or stick out of, you know, funny sort of, maybe you're taking bids or, you know, things that have just happened? There's always something that goes wrong at a sale or, you know.
There's plenty. There's too many to remember. There's not one particular one that comes to mind. Although there was, when Max Donnelly was here with, you know, Magic Business was in receivership for about 5 or 6 years, and Max Donnelly was our receiver, and Max would be one of the greatest guys you'd ever meet, the top bloke. He's the one that got Parramatta out of trouble. You know, he went in there for the National Rugby League and helped Parramatta out. And Max loved racing, and I remember we had, you know, that Saturday night after the races here, we have that auction. And one year there was a guy full as a gug in the bar, roving his hands around, and we took his bid, 100,000 or something. Then the booker up went up to sign it up, and the guy bloody collapsed on the ground, and we had to bring the horse back and resell it. And from that day on, and we still say it today, we will accept no bid from the bar tonight. So that happened 20 or 30 years ago. There was a guy from the bar, but you know, we had guys that have had epileptic fits and bought horses, and then with the bid spotters chased them out to the car park, getting in their car to drive away. So, you know, we have a lot of that.
Now, Charmaine, will we play Fast Five now with David?
Oh, I think we have to, Tim. So, David, we love to play a little game. It is called Fast Five, and it's the first in eight answer which comes to mind. So, first answer which comes to mind. So, the first thing you think of, and we've got five questions to go.
I don't like this. I don't like this at all.
I promise this is not a setup in any way. If you were to invite three people to dinner, dead or alive, who would they be?
Shit. Mr. Jung, because he doesn't speak English, so that makes it easy. Probably Jerry Harvey, because he'd tell a few jokes, and John Singleton.
That would be a very interesting dinner, no doubt.
And now, David, I'll preface this by I have gone to dinner with you, and I'll never be late again. I was 10, 15 minutes late, and it didn't. I knew it was like I'd been told off by my mother. But what is your favourite restaurant or cuisine?
Oh, I love Chinese restaurants anywhere in the world because the food comes quickly. I'm a very impatient man, and when you take a lot of people out to a Western restaurant, they got all the waiter goes ask them all what they want for entrees, and they all change their minds. Then they got to wait half an hour for the main course, and that takes another half an hour. So there's a couple of restaurants here I've banned because they're too slow. So Korean restaurants, Chinese restaurants, I don't care where. I like prompt service. And talking about that there was a Chinese restaurant and they had Mr. Jung from and all big about 30 people at a restaurant in Adelaide. It was the Monday night after the Adelaide Cup. And it took there was only one chef on. They knew we were coming. We were there for an hour before it, and this is a Chinese restaurant. And so I went out the front of the restaurant and stood there and told people not to come in. I said the service is shocking. Oh, they got very angry.
I can imagine they would, yes.
they were hopeless.
Now, we've talked about a lot of funny stories today, and you may have already covered it, but what is your most memorable story in your career or funniest that sticks out if we haven't already covered it?
Oh, gee, Charmaine. there's so many things happened. I remember I went to Mongolia with a guy called Stephen Leong, who was our first agent for China, and we went to Mongolia, and we were treated. We went to this dinner, and they had the red carpet and trumpeters each side, and we had to walk down this alleyway, and all these pretty girls everywhere. It was just amazing. It's something that I'd never seen before, and I've never seen since. Only happened once. And then some of the other stories, of course, the food you get in Korea and that sort of thing. But it's not a funny story, but it was something that was really different.
That's definitely memorable. You'll never ever forget that in your lifetime at all.
Never, yeah,
David. If you're on, you're a host on Getaway for Asia, Getaway Asia. Which country would you take people to or recommend you go?
What, that I like or dislike?
Yeah, if I was to go on a family holiday in July, for instance, take the family in Asia, where should I go?
Oh, Singapore, definitely. Singapore would be, I mean, it's very safe. They speak English. The food's good. I love China. I got to say, I really love China, but it's not a place probably you'd take your family. But it's so interesting in the history of China, the Great Wall and all that sort of thing. But I went to the Great Wall with this political group, and we were down the bars down there with the food, the old guys, and they were walking up the wall. I said, no, I'll watch it. I just stayed down there and watched the wall with the camels and all that sort of thing. And we had a beer waiting for them. And China, you know, no, so I'm not a tourist, but it was just good to drive past. And flying over China, you know, all the snow, when, you know, I've been to Mullamuchi, you know, that right up in the northwest of China where they've had the problems with the Muslims and all that sort of thing. I've been there about five or six times and stayed at a place called Jiasu, which is very little place. And I remember there was a shower in the room, but not a, there was like a, wash basin and the shower, but the water went everywhere. There was nowhere to, you know, for the water to run. It went all over the bedroom, everywhere. So, you know, just places like that were quite amazing. And the food we had there, and you know, that kill a sheep and cook it. No one cooks it better than they do up there in the northwest of China and in Mongolia. And yeah, you heard of Mongolian lamb, but what you get in Chinese restaurants here is Mongolian lamb. It's nothing like it should be. And there was another place in Mongolia I went to, and I've never been so cold in my life. It was no snow, but it was absolutely freezing. And they had these Mongolian ponies that all came in from the paddock into the house yard, and they're all thirsty because they couldn't get any water in the paddock because everything was frozen. And they came in and they had, you know, these big troughs of water. It was just amazing, some of the things that I've seen.
Sounds like you could write a book, David.
Yeah, well, that's on the agenda. That's on the agenda, but it's going to be published after I die.
Oh, too many.
I could get into trouble.
They can't get you if you're dead then, can they now?
No.
Well, I think Tim and I will both buy a copy because I think you've got
I'll give you an autographed copy.
Yeah, I look forward to it.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Tim's going to write it for me.
Oh, right. Okay, thanks for that newsflash.
Yeah, there you go, Tim, your first book. David, finally, if you could have a barn full of horses by one sire, dead or alive, who would that be?
Schnitzel.
You'd be unlucky not to get a colt or two, wouldn't you?
Oh yeah, probably. But I would have had to say Snippets, but now in modern days, because I've always said we should erect a monument for Snippets outside Magic Millions, because you know Snippets was the reason, one of the major reasons Magic Millions was as being so successful. But you know, when we started, Tim and Charmaine, you know, we had Magic Millions, we had 10% of the business. Now we've got 50% plus. It's just amazing what's happened in you know, 20 or 30 or 40 years.
David, thank you so much for your insights today. There are so many stories I didn't quite expect to hear, but I am so much more grateful for hearing them. And you've given us such a great insight into your career, Magic Millions, and your thoughts about the industry as well. So thank you for joining Tim and I.
My pleasure, Charmaine, anytime. Thanks, Tim. Thanks, Charmaine.
Thanks, Dave. We'll have to do it again in about 5 years' time.
Yes. Well, you'll have the book written.
I'll be 82.
And
good luck. Good luck.
Yeah, and Tim will have your book written. So then we'll review, maybe do a bit of a preview. I mean,
we only got to up to about 1997, didn't we?
Yeah,
we did.
Yep.
we could have gone on for bloody 3 hours.
That's right. Episode 2.
Yes. Thank you very much.